Welcome to another episode of Thoughts of a Techno Wizard. It is June 18th, 2022. Oh, Saturday, June 18th, 2022. 9:02 a.m. And today I think I'm going to get a little weird. So listen to yet another Lex Freeman podcast with somebody who I have been very excited for him to talk to for a very long time, and that is Donald Hoffman. So for those that don't know, I believe I made an episode about it a couple years ago, or a year ago, I don't know how long ago it was when I first heard about him, but Don Hoffman wrote a book called The Case Against Reality, and oh my goodness, oh my gosh, it was beautiful. Now, I haven't read the book, so I can't say for myself yet. That's my problem. I'll have to make some time to actually read these books these people are creating. But nowadays, reading is so hard. You know, I had a bunch of web fictions I was reading. I barely even, you know, get to read those on a regular basis. It's just easier to listen to podcasts because I could do that on the side. And I say that as a person who enjoys reading. But usually, I enjoy reading fiction stuff anyways, because, you know, reading is a fun adventure for me. But anyways, Case Against Reality, the idea is there. I feel like I get a good grasp of it because I've listened to hours worth of podcasts about this dude from different people who've interviewed him and things like that. The Case Against Reality is basically him suggesting that our reality, or at least our perspective of reality, doesn't exist. It's an interface, right? I forgot his exact expertise, but he's worked with a lot of physicists and mathematicians and things like that. I think he's something like applied mathematician or something like that. I don't know. But he's worked with a lot of physicists and stuff who've been saying that space and time is not fundamental, right? It's kind of like the core argument of his thesis here, is that space and time is not fundamental. And what does that mean? That means that everything we see and the way we perceive time, you know, things like that, is essentially emergent from whatever is the fundamental aspect of reality. So what does that mean? Right? Because it's hard to really understand, you know, grasp what this truly means. As I understand it, it means that, well, first of all, I guess a better way to describe this is by figuring out how they even got here. Like, why? What led them to this idea? And it seems that what led them to this idea is that each, as they get deeper and deeper into the universe, as into discovering how the universe works and what it's made of and things like that, they get down to, you know, your subatomic particles, your quantum level, quantum scale of things, get down even further into, you know, the fabric of the universe, essentially, or the smallest part that we can really measure, or even get measurements for, because they can't really measure directly. You can't see directly at this level. But below the Planck scale, or around at the Planck scale, because the Planck scale is supposed to be the smallest unit of measurement. But yeah. This is where we get things like the Higgs boson, like this, like a field that's supposed to give other particles their properties or something like that, right? Once you get down to this level, the universe seems to kind of fall apart. Like it doesn't really make sense how the universe, you know, works when we can't see. We can't see any of its constructs, essentially, right? Like, this is where you heard of things like string theory and quantum loop gravity and what are the other ones? Field theory or this, that, and the other. Essentially, these are different theories to try and understand, you know, what the universe is on the basic of scale. Is it continuous, right? Meaning it's like a fabric or something like that, right? It's continuous, or is it what's the term they use? I forgot the exact term they use, but it's essentially like segregated, like water, right? Where it seems continuous on the surface, but actually it's made of really small particles. It's really made of really small things that interact with each other, right? Is it that instead? They don't know. And what makes it worse is that every time you try to measure it, you get different things. You get different results, or you get, you know, really absurd results that says, oh, you know, it's this, and that should mean you get all these other things, but we don't see all those other things, right? And yes, I'm greatly oversimplifying this because I can't really, when physicists and mathematicians get to this level, they speak pure math, right? Like the Cauchy manifold and the, you know, the Rx equals 2R, you know, all this stuff. I'm not that level, you know. That's why I could never go that far in math, because even though I understand why you use letters and all this other stuff, it's difficult for me to really keep in mind. But nonetheless, conceptually, essentially, we don't exactly know why the universe works the way it is at the fundamental level. To the extent that every single theory that tries to come up with, that tries to explain, you know, how we got here on the most basic of levels kind of falls apart, right? To the point where once we try to explain consciousness, right, meaning our own experience of life, our ability to be self-aware and explain the universe and measure the universe and all these other things, right? This experience of consciousness, even the taste of chocolate, right? They love to focus on that, for instance. It's an easy one for any of us to imagine, right? The taste of chocolate, or whatever your favorite candy is, or you know, the experience of red, experience of color, right? All these things, these experiential things, are inherently unexplainable in science. Like, we have no actual good theories to explain why chocolate tastes the way it does. Like, why we get this feeling when we eat things or when we see things or anything. Like, unfortunately, a lot of our science does not adequately explain consciousness. Whoa. Somebody dropped this huge box on the ground in the street. Move out the way. But anyways, yeah, and that's very concerning, right? Like, if our science can't explain consciousness and everyday activity that we all experience, then what do we do with our science, right, that has brought us so much understanding of the universe? Why is it that we seem to not be able to explain any of our conscious experiences, right? So these different things, you know, the fact that physicists have looked at the basics of the universe and they see that space and time is not fundamental and that consciousness can't be explained, led Don Hoffman down this road to begin to ask these things, right? And furthermore, there's some other things I need to point out here, is that when scientists and physicists or whatever were able to said that space and time was not fundamental, you know, to my understanding, some other things that came out of that, or some other things that led to that belief that space and time is not fundamental, is that once again, when you calculate everything that we have today, right, when we calculate what we do know, right, and what we can prove with our tests and our experiments and all this other stuff, when you calculate all this stuff, it actually doesn't preclude, like, it doesn't conclude that what we think about how the universe started, not in terms of the Big Bang, but in terms of, like, the fundamental building blocks of the universe, it doesn't necessarily conclude that that stuff is fundamental, right? So given all the pieces that we know of now, it doesn't allow us to backwards, you know, to backtrack, to backwards engineer ourselves into seeing, you know, the fundamental aspects. But, yeah, so all of that brought him to this. And then he does a lot of Oh, that's what he is. Goodness, he's an evolutionary psychologist or mathematician. I don't know, right? But he uses a lot of game theory, right, in order to figure out his stuff. And so, game theory is essentially a way to understand how we got here, right, and why we do the things we do, from the ability to simulate different Oh shoot, somebody's calling me. One second. Oh my gosh. I did it again, y'all. I was just recording. I was just talking this entire time. Like, I thought I pressed play again in order to resume, my podcast after the person called me. And it turns out I didn't press the wrong one. I forgot there's a play button and there's a, resume button. I pressed the play button and that plays back the audio, but I have my mic on, so I didn't hear the audio going. So I don't know how long it's been. Probably like another 10 minutes I've been just talking. My gosh, I feel like an idiot. So I have to re-explain all of that for the first time for you. So I think I left off talking about the evolutionary payoffs or something like that, right? I believe so. So Don Hoffman, he uses these game theory to explain how evolution brings us to where we are now, right? He explains that for simple life forms, you get certain payoffs that will lead them down certain paths, right? A payoff essentially is like an incentive to or acts as an incentive to continue a certain behavior, right? So let's take a an example here, like a bird. Now this is obviously an advanced example, but say a bird, can well is looking out for food because that food allows it to continue its life, right? When it finds a certain food, it eats it, and that's a payoff, right? It gives it more things, it gives it more energy, goodness, to continue its life, right? And because it has that payoff, it will now go back to that place to look for more food, in the future, or look for other types of food that look similar to that thing, right? And so he was able to use this system of payoffs and things like that, with this game theory. Like, game theory is actually able to simulate and mathematically define payoffs and different evolutionary like paths and all this other stuff, right? So the podcast goes into a great extent of math. So if you're into that, go watch the podcast. It's great. But I don't operate on that level. It's very not my thing. But conceptually, I get it, right? If you bring this back down to a simple level, right? Single-celled organisms, things that can't even see very much, right? They just kind of bump around, looking for food, looking for anything, any energy, right, that will allow them to continue operating, to continue their ecosystem or their homeostasis, their life, right? Once they get something that and consume it, that gives them that payoff, they say, okay, that's a good thing. Keep looking for that, right? And so you can actually trace these sorts of things all the way to where we are today. Oh, well, I'm not sure all the way, but you can actually, see that given these payoffs, right? If you put systems that look for truth, like the true reality of an environment, versus systems that simply look for food, right? Which one evolves, right? Which one actually succeeds in the evolutionary Darwinism, whatever you want to call it, right? You can guess, it's the one that looks for food, right? So as he was able to simulate that and mathematically prove, at least, that systems that look for food or look for these payoffs are more successful than the ones that look for truth, that the ones that are able to see or perceive or go and find the truth, whatever that is, right? If you define what truth is, and then say, okay, look for this versus you just look for food, the one that looks for food is more successful. I'm simplifying this once again, but you know, you get it, I hope. So that means that in our evolution, there doesn't seem to be any proof that we ourselves are seeing the truth, because we have evolved for billions of years for these payoffs, right? To get food or and to reproduce and to do this, that, and the other. So that means that our view of reality is very much skewed towards whatever allows us to reproduce, right? To gain more energy and reproduce and do all these things. And that means that everything that we see today is probably not even what reality actually is, what, you know, the universe, what the fundamental aspects of the universe actually is, right? And that, as you can see, this seems to make sense as to why space and time is not fundamental. Because if our own evolution, if our faculties, if our abilities to perceive the world, to measure the world, to manipulate the world, is in and of itself only manipulates our perception of the world as opposed to the actual world, or manipulates, you know, the interface to the world as opposed to the actual world, then it makes sense why all of our measurements don't add up. It makes sense as to why all of our measurements say, oh, what you're seeing is not actually fundamental. What you're seeing is actually, you know, a higher level abstraction. So I went to this whole thing about, it was beautiful, man. So I have to get right back into it. So a good way to see this, to think about this, is in terms of, oh, wait, before I get to that, I did mention, or I wanted to mention, that there are other scientists who were trying to, you know, not discredit, but, you know, disprove that. They're saying, hey, actually, that makes sense for single cell life forms and this, that, and the other. But when you get to more complex life forms that have eyes, that, you know, evolve eyes and eventually evolve things like brains like we do, you know, perhaps that would actually be an incentive to look to more, to find more truth, right? And there was this one study at Yale or whatever that used like 20,000 evolutionary, you know, payoffs and this, all this and that, the other. And they showed that, hey, actually truth does win, right? The complex life forms that are looking for all these things, that are able to find or that get payoffs from truth are the ones that are successful, as opposed to the ones that look for just food or whatever, right? And Don Hoffman was like, okay, this was a great study and this is a great way to look at it. But the problems with that study is that all these 20,000, you know, elements that things are looking for are actually reducible, right, to these smaller sects. Because if you're looking for, say, for instance, the color of food, the taste of food, this, that, you know, all these other things, they're actually just related to food. Right. I'm simplifying this, but essentially his argument was that you can essentially collapse, right, all those variables into a smaller number of variables, and when you run that test, it goes back with what he had, right? So essentially, he's saying that yes, if you make abstractions, right, if you look for all these abstractions that we see now, then it will lead us to where we are today, but our, you know, ancestors didn't have all these ancestors, as in the single cell organisms going into the multicellular organisms, right? All that didn't have all these abstractions, right? That's the whole point. These abstractions were created; they were emergent out of these simpler, you know, payoffs and light and perspective and all this other stuff, right? So yeah. So even the people that, the leading people that were against this, you know, idea, don't really have a good leg to stand on. All that being said, now we get to the metaphor that I think will help a lot of people really see this, and that he often talks about computers, right? Computers are a great example of what we mean by this idea that our reality is an interface, because that's how computers work today, right? Most of us don't see, or really none of us see the quote-unquote objective reality of a computer, meaning the computer actually functions in the land of electrons, right? Those electrons being on and off, or being flowing through a gate, that is, then that gate is either on or off, either open or closed, and that is what we call the ones and zeros, right? So the first level of abstraction for a computer is actually those ones and zeros. And most of us don't even see that, even programmers. And then the level beyond that is assembly code, right? Most of us don't see that. That hasn't been like, that hasn't been our interface since the 80s or the 70s or whatever, right? And then beyond that, there's like a bunch of other stuff. I don't know. But I know one of them is like a compiler's compiling code. Another one is essentially the application level programming. And that is what most of us are familiar with, or not most of us, but some of us are familiar with, you know, Java, Python, things like that, C++ and all this other stuff, you know, the things that allows them to make games, right? And then beyond that are things like the interface level programming, so HTML, CSS, JavaScript, right? And then beyond that is the actual interface, the GUI, right? The icons, the web pages, all that stuff. So with the computer, you see that we have multiple levels of abstraction. And because of these abstractions, none of us actually see the fundamental reality of a computer. None of us see the electrons flowing in and out of these gates. None of us really understand how that works, you know, or most of us don't. You know, there are people who actually made these computers and understand the hardware and stuff like that, that can understand it to that level, but most of us don't. Vast majority of us do not. And it's so bad to the extent that those of us who only ever see the top level interface, right, actually are limited in our ability to manipulate the computer, right? If you only ever see these icons and these web pages, we don't really understand how to manipulate the computer on a deeper level. We don't really understand how to partition your memory or something like that, right? Most of us don't do that. And most of us have no ability to do that unless somebody, you know, builds a program for us, or us, or unless we learn, you know, the deeper, you know, interfaces, the deeper programming languages. Likewise for our reality, right? There could be several layers of abstraction. And when we evolved, you know, eyes and hands and brains even, those could resemble, or those could be the layers of abstraction of our interfaces, right? These are different layers of interfaces that just stack on top of each other, right? So we can actually be getting further and further away from being able to actually manipulate the reality itself, just like, you know, these interfaces bring us further and further away from the ability to actually manipulate the computer, right? Outside of its, you know, the bounds in which the programmer designed it. Or develop for. And so in terms of our evolution, the ability to perceive, you know, objective reality, the fundamental aspects of reality, are actually, you know, far away from us. But that doesn't mean that we can't, you know, function through life, because obviously, just like on the computer, you can do pretty much anything you want to do, which is usually, you know, get those payoffs, you know, communicate with somebody, you know, find food, order food on DoorDash or whatever. Like, you know, you can get these payoffs through this interfaces. And so this is a great example as to why and how, you know, our reality might be constrained. So he goes so far as to say, you know, okay, if space and time is not fundamental, what is fundamental? Like, what is the underlying structure of reality, right? And he posits that, bro, drums. Sorry. He posits that consciousness is the fundamental aspect of reality, of the universe, or whatever you want to call it. Consciousness is something that is so internal, or so, you know, kind of assumptive that it exists, that you can't, you know, abstract away from it. And yes, that does seem weird for us, because in our current understanding of evolution, we didn't evolve consciousness until, you know, roughly a couple hundred thousand years ago, right? Which is relatively recent in geological times, where you have billions of years, right? So what he goes into, I think he calls himself a conscious realist, or I forgot, but basically he posits that not that everything is conscious, but that everything may be a gate, a portal to consciousness. Right, and now this is gonna seem crazy, right? This immediately gets into spiritual, you know, kind of philosophical things, and he does, you know, a lot of that philosophy and things like that. He also, you know, says that it's very interesting that even though he didn't have any of these, you know, like, he's not a spiritual person, not a religious person. He wasn't trying to prove the existence of God or anything like that, you know, like a freaking Darwin and Newton were. That's, many people don't realize that, is that Newton was trying to prove the existence of God when he came up with the Newton's laws and things like that. But this dude, Dönhoffer, was not. You know, he was just trying to follow the evidence. He was looking at the physics, what the physics was telling him, what the math was telling him, what the game theory was telling him. And it seems to bring him down this path that, you know, fundamental reality might be consciousness. And what that means is that if you were trying to simulate reality, if you were trying to understand how reality works, the only assumption that you can make is consciousness, is that things are conscious. And then you can get everything else from there. All right? That's his argument. And so he's trying to prove this. He's going to prove this, or, you know, what he's trying to do through, you know, using the scientific process, is that he thinks that he can spin up essentially reality just from conscious agents, from the idea that the conscious things interact in some way, things try to portal back into this consciousness. I'll get more into that later. And by looking at how these things interact, how these conscious agents interact, he can actually show how and why space-time developed, how and why the perspective of space-time emerged, how and why we can get all these experiences of fundamental life, right? However, he won't be able to explain why chocolate tastes the way it does, because that is just consciousness, right? Now, that may seem counterproductive, or that may seem, you know, inconclusive, but his argument is that it actually is more complete of a story than assuming space and time is real, is fundamental. And here's why. Because all the other scientists who do believe space and time is fundamental are going to have a very, very tough time trying to spin up consciousness, trying to explain through all these, you know, space and time stories, you know, the physics of things and biology and all this other stuff. They're going to have a very tough time actually pointing to the brain and saying, oh, this is why chocolate tastes the way it does. This is why we see the color red the way we do. Like, you can't really point to the brain and find these things, right? And you're going to have a very tough time even explaining how consciousness itself developed. And that is very troubling, because that means the very tools that you're using to understand the universe can't explain why you exist. Right? At least you as a conscious person. And that is extremely concerning. And at the same time, those people who believe space and time is fundamental are going to have a very tough time explaining why we can't even figure out how space and time itself developed. Right? So on multiple levels, they're actually assuming more things. They're going to have more holes in their argument than him, thing he's taking for granted, the only assumption he's making is that consciousness exists. And that means for him, future people might be able to explain this even further. Maybe he won't be able to explain why, you know, we tasted, why chocolate tastes the way it does. But based on his work, if he can spin up, you know, our entire reality based on these conscious agents and the things that, you know, all things of that nature, then people who better understand this concept and the future generations will be able to, you know, portal into these consciousness more. They'll be able to use his science to do things like edit, you know, the programming, right? Just like if you were able to understand the basic operations of a computer based on the electrons flowing and stuff like that, you can hack it, right? You, the reason why hackers are so quote-unquote scary, or the reason why, you know, certain people can hack computers, is because they understand more about how the computer works. And you can get it to do things that, you know, the programming language or whoever programmed it, you know, didn't really intend. And just a quick aside, I'm using this metaphor of programming and programmers and stuff like that, but that doesn't necessarily mean that our reality was programmed, at least not by a intelligent being. We could still get a, like, this doesn't exactly prove the existence of God as we know it, but I will get into that because this is an interesting concept here. But that doesn't necessarily mean that our reality was necessarily programmed by somebody, right? Because evolution itself is the programmer, but one that goes through brute force, right? Like, there's plenty of many physicists and mathematicians and all that stuff who've shown, you know, like, if you do random things enough times, you will get something that doesn't seem random. Right, and we see that all the time. Just like if you look at things that seem random, you can find patterns in it. That's just how our brains work. It looks for patterns. Likewise, maybe that could be like that. That is proof that our payoff system is skewed towards, you know, non-reality, towards finding patterns that don't really exist. But anyways, you know, that's like, you know, the whole monkey thing. Like, if you put 100,000 monkeys or whatever in a room, just type them away, one of them will, or some time in the future, sometime you'll be able to get, you know, the whole thing of Shakespeare or whatever, right? Or the Tower of Babel, or the room, whatever that is, that if you have all the books in the world in one place, have all the stuff, then all of your life is there, right? Like, basically, given enough time and, you know, effort or whatever, you will get what we have today. You will get complex life forms that self-assemble and all those other things, right? And we see that even with simple things like Conway's Game of Life, right? If you have just these simple things, you say on or off, do this, and then let it go, it creates these complex patterns and stuff like that. So, all that to say that our reality doesn't necessarily have to be programmed consciously, at least by some other person or thing or being, but by understanding how our reality is programmed by evolution, or however it is, then we will be able to better understand it, be able to better manipulate it, and then those people will be able to better describe it, better explain why we experience what we do. So, yeah. I hope you can see why this theory is so freaking interesting, so exhilarating, right? It's a completely new way of viewing the world, and really encourages us to ask questions anew, right? To not take things for granted, to really look at the world. But let me get some more into Don Hoffman's ideas here. So he is saying that consciousness is fundamental, that at the fundamental aspects of the universe, everything is consciousness, some form or the other, and because everything is consciousness, ideas such as, you know, I or me or, you know, individuals may not actually exist on the fundamental level. That means that our feeling of being a self-contained individual may itself be some sort of abstraction, may itself be an interface into the fundamental aspect of consciousness. Right? So he's saying that fundamentally there is just one conscious agent. There's just one conscious being, this thing that can think of itself, you know, and that can perceive things, the world or whatever, right? And outside of it, there is nothing that exists, because it is everything that does exist. There is no outside of it. Even the ideas of outside and in, all these ideas are themselves just interfaces, just things that may or may not actually resemble anything that exists on the base level, on the fundamental level, right? However, you can have these things called conscious agents. Now, these conscious agents are actually, he doesn't really describe them that much, and maybe I missed it, because he goes into a lot of math with this. I don't know how, but it's like all the stuff I'm saying, he has mathematical explanations for how he got there, right? And that's absolutely fascinating to me that he can describe all this stuff with math. Like, I can't even begin to do that. So, you know, if you see some holes in my argument, go look up his stuff first and then come back and tell me what I got wrong. But to my understanding, right, he has these things called conscious agents, and I think he is saying that these conscious agents are themselves different aspects of this one consciousness, of this one singular consciousness, right? So you, me, whatever, right, we're all different perspectives of the same consciousness, right? Now, he doesn't get into this, but this immediately had me thinking about what I've read, like spiritual stuff, right? Because I think I mentioned before that I read this book called The Kabbalion, or otherwise known as The Emerald Tablets of Thoth, or however you say that. And this sounds like a very arcane thing. It is kind of, but it was extremely interesting. It goes into our hermetics and things like that, right? The reason why I found this interesting, because it came to me in a very weird way, like through YouTube comments, but at the same time through other things that completely were unrelated. It was weird. But when I found it, that book was, it was very life-changing for me. And that, I won't go into depth about this, because really, this book, like, you got to read it yourself to really understand this thing. But how this relates to Don Hoffman, there's one concept in his book, in that we are all related to this one mind, right? This, like, we are all part of this one mind. And when that mind imagines things, you know, life happens, right? So life itself is essentially the imaginations of this one central mind. Now, there's a whole bunch of other stuff in there, I'm telling you. If you're interested, if that book is calling to you, go check it out, go find it. But to me, even if you didn't read this book, you can instantly think about probably any other religion, right? The ideas in many religions is that, you know, like, for instance, take Christianity with God. The idea that God is everything, is God is the omnipotent, omniscient power, blah, 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 blah. And we are all like, now, in Christianity, in the Bible, says something like, we are all like the breath of God or something like that, right? Or breath, God's breath gave us life, whatever, right? But actually, a more interesting, to me at least, a more interesting interpretation of God, I think somebody by the name of Thomas Aquinas, somebody was telling me about this person, Aquinas, he was saying that actually a better interpretation of this is that God is being, meaning God is the idea of being in and of itself, right? Of things existing, right? And we're not God, but we are all like concepts of God. We are like parts of God, essentially, right? And again, I'm not really religious anymore. I'm very spiritual, I think. But I'm not saying this as a, oh, let's convert to this. No. All I'm saying is that it is extremely fascinating that this completely non-religious dude got to the same conclusions that many of these religions and spiritual beliefs were using for millennia, right? Animism is the same concept. The idea that everything, you know, has a spirit or has some sort of spiritual form, right? And that goes into panpsychism, right? The idea that everything is conscious, like everything has some level of consciousness. Now, Don Hoffman, you know, makes clear that he's not a panpsychist. He doesn't believe that a rock, for instance, is conscious in and of itself. What he believes is that that rock might be an interface for some segment of this conscious agent. What that segment is, we don't know. But he is trying to, you know, figure that out. So everything we see is essentially what he calls them portals, right? Basically gates or wormholes or, you know, windows into this conscious agent, to this central consciousness and these different conscious agents, right? So different life forms might themselves be a conscious agent that can't communicate directly with us, or communicate through a different means, right? The way it communicates is the way in which, you know, is correlated to the way in which we perceive it. Like a tree, for instance, maybe the only way it communicates without conscious agent is through, you know, this feeling of calm that we get when we stand under the shade, you know, the oxygen that comes out, right? Maybe these are how it is communicating with us, right? Now, this quickly can get into some other things, and I'm going to go into them a little bit, because this is what really fascinates me, is that I think that everything we see, essentially, is... Oh, let me back up a little bit. I think it's super interesting that everything can be a conscious agent, and I really like the idea that there is like this one conscious agent, and every imagination, every thought is essentially, you know, a stream of consciousness. So I think that our life, right, the reason why we experience time the way we do in a linear format, is because it's like this consciousness imagining things, right? Similar to you, right? When you imagine something, you usually imagine it in a step-by-step process, right? This happens, and this happens, and this happens. Even though in your brain, like, technically all of it is happening at once, right? Like, it's all just there. Like, there's no, if you're imagining, you know, yourself opening a door, there's no door in your mind. But you're creating this concept of a door, and then this concept of you walking towards that door, opening the door, going through it, right? In a linear format. Even on your brain, there's no actual, you know, door or walking or anything like that, right? It's all completely made up. Similar to us, right? Different conscious agents could be like a stream of consciousness, right? Where this conscious agent is thinking or imagining, right? Oh, this, what if this, that, and the other, you know? And this relates to this, and this contrasts with this, blah, 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 right? And I find this super interesting. This might be scary to some people, I ain't gonna lie. I tried to talk about it with my partner, and she's like, kind of trippy. But for me, it is extremely exhilarating and exciting, right? Because it shows us that everything we see, like, we're all connected, right? It gives us this idea that not only are we all connected in very literal way, but also, like, when you say, it answers a lot of questions, right? Like, why is there suffering? Why is there this, that, and the other? It's because if you're imagining things, right, you're not really, you can be morally questionable, right? Like, when you imagine something happening, you can imagine a bad scenario, right? And that is just, your brain just functions. Like, you're not really trying to make bad things happen, but you're just letting that thought play out, right? So what if a lot of our life, right, like our life itself, is like these thoughts playing out, the imaginations of this conscious agent, of this larger conscious agent, rather, right? That doesn't mean that we have no power or no meaning or no purpose or whatever. That means that we are part of this bigger thing playing out these different, you know, scenarios and all this other stuff. And even me saying this stuff is part of these scenarios. But even so, like, me saying this stuff is not the complete story. It's a gross oversimplification. All right? It's far more complicated than what I can possibly describe, even what I can possibly imagine, because I'm just one, like, conscious agent. I'm just one of these smaller conscious agents, and there's larger conscious agents. We don't know. They could be countless conscious agents and many levels of these things, right? They could be different windows into this conscious agent. When you look at a rock, that might resemble a part of the conscious agent that has no relation to us, right? Or rather, the relation to, that it has is very limited. Is like a thing that we can use to build with. Like, you know, you might only ever see a person through their picture, right? When you look at a picture, that you're not looking at that person. You're looking at a resembling a resemblance of that person. That person still exists out there somewhere, unless it's like an AI generation. But you might never meet that person. But you can still use that picture, you know, to create some art, for instance, or whatever. Likewise, something like a rock or, you know, these other things that we see that are inanimate, that don't seem to be alive, could be representations of something that is so far removed from us, from our stream of consciousness, from our, you know, the thoughts that, you know, this some larger conscious thing is having, that we might never directly relate to it. We might never directly communicate to it, directly, you know, work with it, but we perceive it as this inanimate object. I'm not sure if I'm making any sense here, but I don't know, this stuff just really excites me. And Don Hoffman, now most of that is, you know, my own ideas there, but Don Hoffman has this great point where he says the reason why this is so important, right, is that if this is true, then we, like I said earlier, we might be able to figure out better ways of manipulating our reality, right? Like if you want to go to the next solar system, instead of us trying to, you know, build an interface that is in a rocket and allows us to go from here to there, somehow spanning, you know, 4 light years, which is thousands of years, you know, at our speed, we might actually just be able to teleport, right? Like we can figure out powers, y'all. Like if we can figure out how to program, if you want to call it that, right? If we can figure out the deeper level aspects of our reality below this interface that we call in our brains, in our hands, in our eyes, then we might be able to, boom, instantly change, you know, our life, our world, where we are in our world, and so on and so forth. And that is beautiful. That is what I'm all about, like the techno wizard, right? The ability to change reality just by thinking. So you can see why this excites me so much. Now, I'm not sure if there's anything I can do to really, you know, add to this theory, but I'm very much looking forward to see if anything there is. And I'm you know, I've been looking at it a little bit on and off for the past couple of years or so, or whenever it was I first found it. It's been a while since I really looked into it, but it's always been like in the back of my mind, and I constantly find other ideas to it. And in fact, one of my concepts of free will, right, the why free will is an illusion, comes from this idea, right? Because if what's fundamental is actually this central consciousness, this base consciousness, and if our life itself is essentially a stream of consciousness, like a stream of thoughts, then yeah, we don't really have free will. But that also means that free will it is the part that's meaningless. Like we like to think that life is meaningless without free will, but it's all actually the other way around. The concept of free will makes life meaningless, right? Why? Because we don't have it. Like if we don't have this thing that we think we have, that we think we need in order to have meaning and purpose and happiness or whatever, then actually that actually means we're deluding ourselves through life. And that explains so much about why people feel so unhappy all the time, why there's so much, you know, depression and anxiety and anger and all this other stuff, and just this feeling of constant surface level, you know, happiness that doesn't really, that's just so ephemeral. I really think that many of these spiritual leaders, right, not the, you know, religious pastors and stuff like that, but no, like these spiritual leaders that would meditate and understand the concepts of life and are able to experience great joy. Now, granted, there are those that also just think that no feeling is good, that you just have no feelings and that's what life should be about. I don't think so. I personally believe that, you know, you can meditate and understand more about life, and that allows you to have more of an appreciation for life, right? So in my opinion, in my thoughts on this, and I think this might be somewhat similar to Don Hoffman, right? Because Don Hoffman says he's been meditating for like 3 to 4 hours a day. 3 to 4 hours at least a day since for 10 years. This dude is wild, man. I barely get like 10 minutes in. But nonetheless, like, he mentions how this concept really allows us to be more grateful for what we have. And at the same time, to not care as much about these ephemeral things. Like, the idea of getting a big house, a car, and all this other stuff, right? Like, sure, we might need these payoffs in order to continue this form of life that we have today. But that stuff doesn't really mean much, right? Because it's just the interface. It's just like, you know, when you're playing a video game and you buy a house in a video game. It's just in a video game, right? It doesn't really, you know, affect your real life, unfortunately. And many people like to escape into the video game and say, oh yeah, we get all this happiness, but that happiness is in and of itself surface level. It doesn't feel fulfilling, right? As a person who actually played some games and was able to get some in-house living or this, you know, stuff from the end game, in-game housing, right? Like, there was this game called Adventure Quest Worlds, and I was super proud of it because I couldn't afford to get any of the, you know, in-game currency that you had to, of course, pay cash for. So I just, you know, was working the whole time in that game. Not really working, but, you know, playing the game, grinding. There we go. Goodness, my words. I was grinding in this game to the point where I was actually able, like, if you find certain, you know, ways to get it, you can actually earn some of this in-game currency that's usually just cash-centric, or you can find really cool stuff that, you know, tricks out your house. So I was able to have, you know, really cool house, an environment, built like a little guild, and it was mad cool, right? But it was ephemeral. It was surface level. Like, as soon as you stop playing that game, it's, you know, it's gone. And even when you're playing that game, you realize that, you know, that's it. Like, it doesn't really give you anything more, right? If you don't have friends playing this game, right? Or if you just get bored of the game, like, it doesn't really get you much more than that, right? And I learned that at a very young age. But unfortunately, people are much older and learning this in real life, where they think that, oh, they'll feel the happiness they get if they get this house, if they get this car, if they get this job, even if they get this partner or whatever, right? But when you get there, you realize that, oh, that's it. Like, it's not really brings you much fulfillment, right? You think that's what life is about, but then you realize that you still feel so empty inside. So I think this theory, if this is true, right, can really help us to truly find more fulfilling, you know, things to do, and to truly find more, be more fulfilled in our lives. If we see that we're connected to every individual, every other life form, every non-life form, right, on this earth, in this universe, but we're just different perspectives of the same life form or the same consciousness, right, then that allows us to have a richer feeling of connection, right? Like, I feel I can be around these trees and feel like they're here for me. Like, I can hear them in a way, right? I can communicate with them. I can, you know, feel connected. And in doing so, I think it allows us to be closer and closer to that base consciousness, to that, well, one might call it the God consciousness, right? I don't like to use that term because it's a very loaded term. And I think, you know, Don Hoffman is similarly, you know, not trying to use that term, but it is a very similar feeling, right? Like, the reason many people are religious, in addition to, of course, tradition and things like that, is also because of the goal here, right? It's like this, when you pray, as a religious person, you actually feel, and we'll be able to measure that scientifically too. Like when you pray, you actually feel connected. You feel like you're communicating with something, like you're, you know, you feel differently. You feel more connected or more something, more just there, right? But it doesn't work anymore when you no longer feel like that religion makes sense or is complete or is real. But if we can find a scientific, you know, understanding, right? And I don't, it doesn't have to be, it's not that the science is better than religion or something like that. It's just that if we can find something that is measurably consistent, right, that doesn't, you know, doesn't fall prey to loose interpretations that completely change and can completely lead us astray and completely, you know, abuse, you know, many of these feelings and these, this connection. Like the reason why religion is so prone to this authoritarianship, authoritarian people, right, taking over and, you know, controlling things, is because it's like they can say, oh, I have this connection to this God, I have this connection to this greater being, this feeling of communication and connection and community, right? And without me, like, I can rescind your communication, I can rescind your connection. You're essentially being ostracized from this group. And that's a deep, deep fear for all of us humans who are inherently a social organism, right? In this theory, maybe we can even argue that maybe all humans are this, or one conscious agent, right? One type of conscious agent. Like, there's many of these conscious agents. We're one type of conscious agent. And then that conscious agent splits into all of us humans as smaller conscious agents that make up this larger one. And that's why we feel all so, you know, connected, and at the same time so disparate, right? Because just like when you're having thoughts, right? If you have an imagination, if you're imagining yourself here, but you also imagine yourself there, you can have the same, you know, like it's you having two separate imaginations, but those imaginations clash with each other, right? Like, it feels mutually exclusive. You can either do this or do that, right? And we can be mad at ourselves for for feeling these things. So like, oh, why can't I decide between this and that, right? Likewise, it could be that all of our life, right? all of us individuals are essentially like different imaginations of this conscious agent thinking of itself in these different circumstances or these different areas or whatever, right? And through that, we are able to explore, right? I'm gonna conclude with this because 2 minutes left. But what also really brings me to this is that we, like, the purpose of life, right? The purpose of our existence is it's like this conscious agent exploring life. Right? Because if you are omniscient being, right, if you know everything that is and was and will ever be, you don't actually get to experience all those things as you know them, right? Or a better way to put it is, the only way in which you can actually experience the things that you know is through not knowing things, is through these subjective experiences, right? I would go so far as to argue that the only way you can ever know all of objective reality is by being this omnipotent, omniscient, conscious thing. But that's not a life, because you know everything. You can't go anywhere. You can't do, like, everything is there. And so having a mortal, subjective life is the way in which that thing knows these, what it knows, is how that thing knows, you know, everything. So each thing is in and of itself its own life. I'm not sure if I explained that well, but to me, that's like the purpose of life, is to help ourselves, i.e. this conscious agent, which is ourselves, right? Know things, know the universe, understand the world. This goes all the way back to that saying, you know, consciousness is the universe's way of knowing itself. I think that's, you can take that very... Okay, that was a little bit sudden. I was trying to hurry up and finish it, but it cut me off. But yeah, you can take that very literally, right? Consciousness is the universe's way of knowing itself. Whoever came up with that, genius stuff. Maybe they were peering into something deeper. Right? I think we already have so many truths, so many insights into this deeper idea, because we come from this idea, because it's inherent in our consciousness and our ability to, you know, be aware, to see the universe. Some form of us remembers, you know, this larger connection or this larger existence. Some part of us is able to feel this. And as you meditate more and more, as you are able to become more and more aware of our reality as it is, not as how you see it, but as it is, or as we think it may be, right? You are able to see or feel or perceive, you know, or at least think about more and more of this objective reality or this deeper, you know, consciousness-based reality. I think it allows us to really just be more complete people as well, right? And I do understand that if this holds true and that, you know, each of our lives is essentially a thought and this larger being and this larger set of beings, then perhaps that means that, unfortunately, many of us may not be fated, if you will, to see a different world, to feel this experience. Maybe. I don't know. I don't think so. Right? Maybe that's just my own, you know, conscious thought, my own stream of consciousness that, you know, biased me towards this feeling. And that may be true as well, but we don't know. And that's what makes it so enjoyable. That's what makes life so enjoyable. The fact that we don't know. And we are constantly, we can spend our entire life, our entire existence, not knowing and trying to learn more. And this also means that there is always more to learn. That's another exciting part of this, right? Don Hoffman was talking about how when he was growing up, the experts at the time were saying, oh, we solved physics. There's no more interesting problems to be solved in physics, right? But this shows that, no, we haven't. We haven't solved physics. We haven't gotten to the bottom of how our universe works. And there's so many more interesting problems to solve. In fact, we probably will never know everything. We probably will never get to the bottom of it. And even though that may, for some people, be a cause for alarm or a cause for, you know, angst or whatever, that's actually very exciting. But yeah, somebody's calling me once again, so I'll go. Thank you for listening, as always, and have a great day. And let me know what you think about these things. Yeah. But yeah, have a great one. See ya. Bye-bye.